Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In our first program of 2020, as the Project Censored Show enters its 10th year, we discuss the importance of whistleblowers and protecting a truly free press. On today's show, we welcome the managing editor of Shadowproof.com. Journalist Kevin Gostola rejoins the program today. Also, we catch up with editorial cartoonist and author Ted Rall. We'll get updates on his case against the Los Angeles Times, and we'll discuss current events. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we welcome back to the program the managing editor of Shadowproof.com and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure, journalist Kevin Gostola. Kevin Gostola should be no stranger to people who read Project Censored's annual books or who have listened to the Project Censored show over the last decade. Kevin Gostola is one of the few people that has covered whistleblower cases like Chelsea Manning's and Julian Assange's from the very beginning, going way back. Kevin also has recently been writing more about Chelsea Manning and, again, this information war in which we seem to find ourselves. He's also recently weighed in on the assassination of Soleimani in Baghdad and the recent strike there. So we're going to talk to him for a segment in today's program, Kevin Gostola, about a number of things happening. And if you want to learn more, please go to shadowproof.com. So Kevin Gostola, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks.
We were talking before we got on air here, and you had mentioned Max Blumenthal and a skit he was doing recently with Jimmy Dore and talking about how we're in the midst of an information war. And that reminded me, of course, of some things that Nolan Higdon and I wrote about in United States of Distraction. We were talking about Rene DiResta, who is the research director of the New Knowledge Firm, which is a contractor for the Senate Intelligence Committee. They're the ones that have been talking about that we are in sort of this digital Maginot line. We're in an information war, and the human mind is the territory. DiResta writes that if you're not a combatant in the information war, then you are the territory. Right, and we've recently seen yet again even more explosive information about Cambridge Analytica and manipulating information online through social media. So it's really important to cut through all that noise with solid investigative journalism, transparently sourced facts. And of course, it's another reason why we really need to herald and support real whistleblowers. So I wanted to start with you in the conversation under the umbrella of this information war. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what's been going on recently with Chelsea Manning. And I know that you are going to England perhaps in the near future on the Assange case. Could you please tell us a little bit about what's been happening with the Chelsea Manning case as she has spent yet another birthday in prison?
It just so happens that I'm talking to you on day 300 of Chelsea Manning's incarceration. And she's been in jail for resisting a grand jury that is basically set up and has been set up for a number of years now. I can go all the way back to 2010 that has existed in some form. And it's been set up to destroy and dismantle WikiLeaks, to basically stop dissident media organization from being able to operate. She owes $191,000 in fines as well, because every day she's charged $1,000 for continuing to resist this grand jury that she's resisting in principle, not only because she sees it as a threat to press freedom, but also because she's principally opposed to grand juries in general. She wrote to the judge last year, middle of the year, about how grand juries function, how they've been set up to target particularly left-wing activist groups historically, how they've targeted groups that fought for social justice, whether they be Black, Latino, or let's even consider solidarity movements that stood up for Puerto Rico or Cuba, different independence movements that have existed in the U.S. that have been targeted specifically by the FBI. And so he had that information, and he's had that information, but has decided to continue to maintain this coercive confinement of Chelsea Manning. And in the last couple of weeks, we've seen Niels Meltzer, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, come forward and advocate for Chelsea Manning and say to the U.S. government that he wants crucial information about what is happening and their justification for keeping her in a jail and why they believe this is actually going to be effective in making her testify. Coercion is supposed to produce an outcome where the person actually does provide testimony. But if she's principally opposed to it, then this can't be considered an effective means of coercing somebody to provide testimony. Instead, it's punishment. It's punishment because you are not complying with what they've asked you to do. And there's been other cases throughout the U.S. involving people who identify as anarchists who have actually gotten out of jail and not had to testify. Even the Pacific Northwest specifically is what I'm talking about. You've seen people actually go free because they refuse to testify before a grand jury. And the judge determines, well, there's nothing you're going to be able to do to get them to change their mind. So I have to release them from jail. And that should be the case with Chelsea, especially since Julian Assange has been indicted. There's no other additional information she has to provide or should be asked to provide at this moment. Anything else they need, they can figure out and work it out through any sort of trial or through the process of this extradition case.
And you mentioned Assange here. You know, Assange was jailed for violating bail conditions and now is in this maximum security prison still in London, where we have information about how he's being treated, isolated, drugged, tortured. It's pretty remarkable that this hasn't really broken into the U.S. press at all. What are your views on that? I know that you're going to be talking more about this, and you're certainly going to be writing more about it. But based on what you just said, how do you see that case stacking up as yet another example of shooting the messenger?
Well, it's important to talk about both Assange and Chelsea Manning right now, because as we're leading into having a discussion about some of the work I've done around Soleimani, you actually see that in the press, they went back and referenced diplomatic cables that were disclosed and published by WikiLeaks, disclosed by Chelsea Manning to their organizations, made public. So nearly 10 years later, we still have this incredible database of information from the State Department being relied upon. So you have this source, you have the source in jail, and then you have this person who's engaged in journalism who is being put through this extradition proceeding that could very well end up causing a slow death just because of the fact that his health has been deteriorating. And the fact that the UK government in particular, as well as the US government, but the UK government is the one that has him in their jurisdiction right now, they do not respect political asylum, and they have not. And in doing so, they basically said that he violated his bail by seeking asylum from Ecuador. And so they're really making a mockery of this whole concept of seeking asylum. That, to me, is a big deal.
It is a big deal. I'm imagining that that's partly why you are planning to go. When might you be doing this, and will you be able to be in touch with Assange?
I don't know if there will be any jail visits to see Julian Assange, but there's a major extradition hearing coming up on February 25th that'll start. It's expected to go about 3 to 4 weeks. It's a very long, drawn-out process, but it's going to be the first opportunity that we see to see the U.S. put on its full case for why it believes it should be able to target Julian Assange. But it's also going to be an opportunity for the defense, and they're glad because initially this was going to take 4 days. Mm-hmm. And now it's much longer, and they see this as a great opportunity to expose the farce that is this effort to bring him to the United States. Now, the problem is he's going to probably see this go through 2 more levels of courts before it's over. So we're thinking it could be 2 to 3 years, if not longer, through appeals before this is all worked out. If your health is deteriorating in jail and they won't release you, that's a huge issue. And on one hand, we've seen when he was indicted for these violations of the Espionage Act, many, many outlets actually come forward and state clearly that this posed a threat to press freedom. It's important to emphasize that The Obama administration did not take this step in 2013. They recognized that it would be wrong to indict Julian Assange for the publication of materials that Chelsea Manning had disclosed to him and the WikiLeaks organization. So they backed off because it would actually threaten the New York Times and the Washington Post. They called it the New York Times problem within the Obama administration. But the Trump administration decided that they are going to proceed and target Julian Assange. And they're actually going after specifically the publication of materials around the Afghanistan war. These Afghanistan war logs that exposed things like there was a Task Force 373 that was an assassination squad going around Afghanistan carrying out night raids and torturing people and such. And so you've seen them come forward, but now you haven't seen a recognition and acknowledgement that Julian Assange is a journalist. You have right. not seen solidarity from them in that respect. And I particularly, at the end of the year, in December, went after the Committee to Protect Journalists yes. because they published this thing where they anticipated that there was going to be a backlash against them for not including him in their list of journalists who are being jailed around the world globally. And they excluded him, but they knew they were going to get a backlash. So they had one of their people prepare a piece that could deal with what was coming by saying that they acknowledge that it's a threat to press freedom. But it was just insane that they didn't give him this label. And I think a lot of it has to do with the people who are on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, who are part of these establishment media organizations, people like Bill Keller, who have done a lot to stir up animosity towards Julian Assange over the last 10 years. And the fact is that he's part of unions, journalist unions. He's part of a trade organization in Australia that is a trade union of journalists. And so he's absolutely a journalist.
Journalist, publisher. I'm familiar with the piece that you're referencing from the Committee to Protect Journalists. And I agree with your assessment about the twisting and turning, the acrobatics that they seem to be going through to have it both ways, not offending people on their board, not offending funders, not offending the establishment press on one level. But I mean, on another, it seems as though that they have to at least acknowledge that there's a serious problem here in terms of how this case pretends for press freedom moving forward.
Yeah, and I would just quickly add to that, that there's been this fiction that they've created that if they say he was a source and not a journalist they collaborated with, that maybe they wouldn't get in trouble if the governments came after them for publishing these materials. And I think that any prosecutor that wants to go after a violation of so-called national security secrets, they just aren't going to maintain that distinction unless you're totally subservient to them. So what you're actually doing is you're sacrificing your independence as journalists. And I think that they themselves know that. I mean, we've seen even with the New York Times back in 2010, they actually had meetings with State Department prepping them for what they were going to release about the diplomatic cables. And that was obviously to guard against any sort of thought that the Justice Department might have had to go after them and try to impose prior restraint, you know, thinking of like the Pentagon Papers and how they could have gone after the New York Times and said, we are going to block you from publishing these materials from WikiLeaks. So today, you see them just making it clear that we're not like Assange, we're different. And I think that's true, but I don't actually think that that's an endearing thing to say that you're different than Julian Assange.
We're speaking with journalist Kevin Gostola of shadowproof.com. Before we take a break here in a moment, I also wanted to call attention to your Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. The first show of 2020 you did, Dissenter Weekly, with guest John Curiaco. And of course, listeners of this show know John Curiaco, the CIA whistleblower that was sent to prison for outing the torture program. You talked about the UN official, the special rapporteur Niels Melzer, that has actually condemned both the treatment of Manning and Assange. So we even have in the UN this significant voice that's calling attention to both Manning and Assange and how what's happening to them is terribly unjust. Could you talk about your conversation with John Curiaco?
And this was part of a show that I started last year because I wanted to, as people were really getting into this Ukraine call whistleblower case, I saw it as an opportunity that if people really wanted to pay attention to whistleblower stories, well, then I was going to jump on this moment and have a show where every week we ran down whistleblower stories and gave people a chance to see that there's all these different things going on around the country that's not limited to just what's happening at Capitol Hill. This drama, political drama going on between Republicans and Democrats. And so John and I just talked about how Niels is this great advocate, really. I mean, he's become one of Assange's greatest advocates internationally and somebody who's been hounding the UK government. He actually deserves a lot of credit for the Swedish government dropping their case, their investigation into sexual allegations into Julian Assange that had festered for 10 years and stopped and started and had many different prosecutorial mishaps, I would say, and things that were inexplicable, but largely probably driven because it was all to keep him in limbo so the U.S. could build their extradition case against him or extradite him if he came to Sweden. And so, yeah, we talked, and John and I are both very concerned about what could happen to Assange and where this all may go in the next year.
Indeed, and again, this is the Dissenter Weekly Update episode, right? Part of the podcast.
Yeah, so just to be clear here, Shadowproof launched a streaming show on YouTube. It's not a podcast, just so that every week for a half hour, people can tune in and get a roundup of whistleblower stories as well as updates on the latest with Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, and other specific cases we're following. And that's largely to fill a void that has been created by the establishment media, ignoring it and only paying attention to partisan whistleblowers that fuel things like Russiagate hysteria.
Thank you so much, Kevin Gostola, for sharing that information. And you can link to the YouTube program from shadowproof.com, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's all there at shadowproof.com. I'd also like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with journalist Kevin Gostola. He's the managing editor of Shadowproof and produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. We're going to continue our conversation with Kevin Gostola after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're speaking with Kevin Gostola. He's the managing editor of Shadowproof.com. He also produces and co-hosts the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin Gostola rejoins us for the first program, Project Censored, for the year 2020. And we're talking about whistleblowers, talking about Chelsea Manning, we're talking about Julian Assange, talking about media censorship of really key issues that matter to us in this great information war. And Kevin Gostola, this also means that we're going to turn our attention to the latest elephant in the room, which is the assassination of Soleimani, the general from Iran that was going to Iraq, purportedly even on a mission to de-escalate or have potential future peace talks with Saudis, and was assassinated by a U.S. drone. And of course, most Americans had no idea who Soleimani was, had never heard of him before, but you know, before the 24 and 48-hour news cycle was out, Americans were being groomed to hate him, to celebrate this violation of international law. And you recently wrote a piece about this. This is a Shadowproof, and you wrote a piece, "To Make Sense of Soleimani Assassination, Media Turned to Disgraced Iraq War General David Petraeus." And of course, the media has turned to many other shills for the military-industrial complex on this topic, but the case of Petraeus is a very interesting one. Could you talk to our listeners about the Soleimani situation and particularly your angle on it?
This wasn't the first piece I put out, but this is my follow-up piece, just looking at how there has been propaganda pushed out there by the State Department since the assassination. In my view, if you look at what's coming out, you look at Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and if you pay attention to some of what Vice President Mike Pence has been saying, then you can really clearly identify that this is originating from a specific faction of neoconservative people within the Trump administration. You could connect them back to John Bolton. You could connect it to the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, is the super right-wing think tank accused of Islamophobia, et cetera, that has a lot of influence when it comes to being able to steer the Trump administration, it would seem. And then David Petraeus was on Face the Nation on Sunday morning, and he adds to that, he repeats it, but he's an incredible example here of how the media is being sucked into this propaganda, because he fought against Qasem Soleimani. They were both on the battlefield at the same time in the 2000s, with Petraeus being the head of Central Command, and then with Soleimani leading forces on the other side. And what you've heard repeated is this claim that Soleimani had blood on his hands because hundreds of U.S. troops have been killed by him, because he was apparently involved in engineering these explosives or supporting these militias that created these explosives that went off. And that's just not true. If you look to Gareth Porter, yes, did an incredible piece
last July,
that dismantled this whole thing and showed that, in fact, you could not tie it back to Iran, that even our own U.S. military had admitted that they were not responsible. You know, the other thing that's interesting with Petraeus is that he really should not even be somebody that they're going to talk to.
It's interesting you brought it up. I was looking at Gareth Porter's article right now. Stephen Zunis just published another article at The Progressive about the same issue. It says that the Pentagon doesn't have any study, documentation, or data to provide journalists that would support any such figure. But this is what Vice President Dick Cheney was using, yeah, right at the time, to try to justify a war against Iran. And this is over a decade ago.
Yeah. So you have that. And then, to be clear, anyone who's turning to Petraeus to talk to him needs to face up to the fact that he was involved in overseeing paramilitary death squads in Iraq, which, by the way, were actually Shiite militias and could be said to perhaps be linked to Iran, but he was actually empowering them so that they could ethnically cleanse Sunni Arabs out of particular neighborhoods in Iraq and make it easier to control the population and to diminish the insurgency that they were dealing with as they tried to secure and occupy Iraq in the late 2000s. This was part of the surge that is fabled, that everyone says is highly successful, was actually reliant upon ethnic cleansing. And we've also seen that there were detention centers set up to torture people, where he employed the Salvador option, and Colonel James Steele, who is connected back to the dirty wars in Central America, was brought in to help manage this strategy of allowing these different detention centers to round up people and torture them. He wasn't personally involved in it, but he knew it was happening, and he looked the other way. And then there's also the fact that he's a leaker, and he lied to the FBI. And usually this kind of thing for any official, I mean, we talked about Chelsea Manning at the beginning of this segment. If Chelsea Manning was invited on a show to talk about Iran, nothing that she said would be allowed before she faced up to the fact that she had engaged in an act of treason. That's just how our media works. And so David Petraeus is able to go on any of these news programs and not talk about his past history of compromising these really top secret black books that had identities of covert officers, war strategy, intelligence capabilities, and notes from private discussions with President Barack Obama, which he passed off to his own personal biographer, who was going to write a fawning portrait of him, and he was having an affair with her. And again, I'm not making some kind of puritanical judgment here. I'm just saying that Margaret Brennan has him on Face the Nation, and none of this past history is brought up at all. No. Not to mention another point that I want to make quickly here, not to mention that Patrick Coburn has called it the Alice in Wonderland strategy, because it's so absurd that there are all these people that we demonize for the stuff that they were willing to do to fight back against the Islamic State, as well as Al-Qaeda fighters. You know, you go down the list, you have Iran, the Syrian government, Hezbollah, the PKK. These are all groups that have been credited as actually fighting ISIS. Meanwhile, our efforts, the so-called coalition of the willing, as Patrick Coburn would say, not really as effective as what this coalition was able to do. The people that were actually deploying and investing, and it's interesting that the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces, their leading commanders, I believe his last name is Mohandas, was one of the other people with Soleimani who got killed as well in that assassination.
Well, and there was very little mention of that. That didn't get a lot of coverage in the press.
And I think the reason was because if you're sucked into the propaganda, the United States government wasn't expecting to kill this person. It didn't seem. So everything was primed to respond to the Soleimani assassination. But to deal with this leader of the PMF was not something they expected. And I think they really set off a tinderbox here, because we've seen the Iraqi parliament pass this resolution to push for the expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq, which where were they were there because they were involved in trying to secure Iraq from the Islamic State. But as that threat has diminished greatly, there's really no reason for them to remain there. Obviously just there to fight a proxy war out of Iraq against anything that we see as being connected to Iran. And that's what's been made so abundantly clear after this assassination. And people like Petraeus really crystallized this fact that this imperial hubris that all of these people have is just driven by their hatred towards Iran and their insistence that they not recognize that someone like Soleimani, who probably was as brutal as Petraeus in the way that he engaged in warfare, yes, was actually tremendously effective. And one other point that I want to dismantle as propaganda that's out there before we wrap is that in Syria, they have mentioned that Soleimani backed this offensive against Aleppo in 2016 that they call, you know, very brutal. They condemn the sort of bloodshed. They say, you know, he just supported the murderous dictatorship of the Syrian government by leading forces that went into Aleppo to force out the rebels. But what they leave out is that there were Al-Qaeda people from Jabhat al-Nusra that were in Aleppo and had taken over parts of it, and that they were really pushing back, not to mention the fact that it's well known now, thanks to Max Blumenthal, who we mentioned at the top of the show, that John Kerry had told anti-Assad Syrian regime change advocates or activists that they decided to allow ISIS to spread throughout Syria and that they were just going to manage it because they believed this would effectively force Bashar al-Assad to negotiate with them and negotiate an end to his rule over Syria. And so they allowed it to get worse, and Iran and Russia saw this and decided they needed to send their own forces in order to protect their security. So that's another element that is completely missing from any media coverage of this assassination.
It's important to point out this kind of propaganda. And again, this attack was planned. It seems that Israel was in the know about it. It's hard to believe the Saudis didn't know, but I guess we wait and see there. But this is a purposely destabilizing event that is also being used to manufacture more consent for war against Iran. There's more propaganda going on here, too, in that Kellyanne Conway claiming that Trump didn't threaten Iranian cultural sites, but he clearly did do that. Interestingly enough, Pentagon officials even publicly stated that they had no plans in doing that because it was against international law. They'd be seen as war crimes. I guess we should say, Kevin Gostola, we live in strange and interesting times.
The important thing is to have empathy for those working class people who are in these countries.
Yes.
And I can understand why they in their own country, in Iran, I can understand why Iranians, despite the repression that we know to exist, and I do not deny it, but I can see why they would be really sad and really offended and feel like they really wanted revenge against the United States for going after somebody who was a leader. I speak about it in these terms because I think it's the only way we prevent war. Because the only way you prevent going after another country is by not demonizing their people.
Yeah, indeed. And this is, again, all part of this propaganda campaign. We began our segment with Kevin Gostola of Shatterproof.com talking about Rene D'Arresta and the idea that we are involved in this information war. And so I wanted to bookend it with Eddie Bernays back in 1928 in Propaganda. Bernays wrote, "It remains a fact that in almost every act of our daily lives, whether the sphere of politics or business or social conduct or ethical thinking, we're dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness our old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world." Indeed, we are in the midst of that campaign ever long. Kevin Gostola, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the Project Censored Show. Thank you for your important work. I'm sure we'll have you on again in the near future to talk more about your work, about Assange, also perhaps Rania Kalek. Shadowproof.com is the website. Kevin Gostola, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Up next, after the musical break, we're going to be joined by editorial cartoonist and author Ted Rall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we welcome back to the program Ted Rall. He is a political cartoonist at anewdomain.net, editor of Skewed News, a graphic novelist and author of many books of art and prose. These include several biographies, graphic biographies, by our publishers at Seven Stories Press, including one called Trump. He did another one on Bernie and also Snowden. You can learn more at rall.com, RALL.com. Ted Rall, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mickey. I really appreciate it.
So, Ted, we've had you on the show for various reasons in the past, and of late, the last time or two that we've talked on the Project Censored Show, we were talking about the very strange and very important court case that you have been ensnared in that involves the Los Angeles Police Department Union, the Los Angeles Times, where you used to work. There have been some updates to this case, and it involves the anti-SLAPP laws and so forth. Could you please remind our audience, why is this case so significant and important, and you are now all the way up to the California Supreme Court?
I'll make this as simple as possible. It's a long, but it's not really a complicated story, so I'll try to just hit the high points or the low points, as the case may be. The reason it's important is because it's about a collision between two conflicting free speech First Amendment rights. One is the right of a publication like a daily newspaper or a magazine or a radio station to express itself. And the other one is about the individual free speech rights of a publication or other media company's employees. Usually, if there's a free speech issue, for example, you as a radio talk show host, you are going to be on the same side as the radio station that is broadcasting you because you're being censored by some sort of outside interference, perhaps a government agency, perhaps a commercial entity, who knows. But sometimes, and it's not something that people talk about very often, there's a conflict where the entity that is supposed to be defending you, in my case, the Los Angeles Times, my former employer, is actually the entity that's censoring you and, in my case, defaming me. And so the question comes before the courts, whose rights are more important? The right of the individual journalist to protect their reputation and to be employed and not be retaliated against, or the right of the newspaper or other media entity to not have to run work that they don't want to run for whatever reason. So this is all surrounding something called the anti-SLAPP statute. The theory behind the anti-SLAPP law where California is one of 28 states, it's the first of 28 states to pass it, is that there's a problem with frivolous lawsuits, defamation lawsuits, filed against whistleblowers and small individuals, and that these people need protection from people like real estate developers who are trying to crush them and tie them up in court. So the way it works is, let's say Donald Trump wants to harass a community activist who's opposed to one of his hotel projects. So he files a fake defamation lawsuit, a frivolous defamation lawsuit against this community activist. And he figures, well, I'm rich. The person's poor. She'll have to shell out all this money and be tied up in court for years. And that'll screw her up in terms of her ability to organize against my project. Well, so she can now, under the anti-SLAPP statute, file an anti-SLAPP motion. And so what that does is it stops the lawsuit, and a judge will assess whether it's in fact a frivolous lawsuit or not. And if it is, the judge deems that it is, then the judge tosses it. And what makes the statute very powerful is that Donald Trump, in my fictional example here, would have to pay our poor community activists legal fees. She might be tied up in court for a little bit, but not very long, and she doesn't have to pay the bills. That's the theory of it. The problem is that under the Constitution, you can't have different classes of defendants and plaintiffs. So big corporations have started using anti-SLAPP statutes in order to silence their critics. They're doing it the other way around. And that's what happened to me. They've turned the statute on its head. I was the cartoonist for the LA Times from 09 to 15, 6 years. And during that time, unbeknownst to me, the LAPD pension fund bought Tribune Publishing, which was the parent company of the LA Times, and effectively became the owner of the LA Times. I didn't know about this, but certainly the publisher, who was buddies with the LAPD, did know about it. And they conspired at the highest levels of city government and publishing to get rid of me. And so the chief of police, Charlie Beck, met with Austin Buettner, who was the publisher of the LA Times. Austin Buettner is a multi-billionaire hedge fund guy, currently the head of schools in Los Angeles County, and also has aspirations to become either mayor of LA or governor of California. So Beck met Buettner and, believe it or not, conspired to get rid of cartoonist Ted Rall. This is all in the court record. The LA Times completely admits all this. We found out through the LA Times that this is how it happened. In fact, they used it as their defense because they're claiming that they have an absolute privilege to defame under something called Code 49D of the California Civil Code, and that's their defense. Anyway, they met, and Buettner received from Beck an audio recording that purported to show that I had lied in a blog that I wrote that went along with a cartoon that was about a jaywalking controversy back in 2001. And so it's a very trivial thing, but it's ended up having some big ramifications. They fired me. They published two pieces in the LA Times that have been definitively proven scientifically to have been false. The evidence was ginned up. It did not show what they said it showed. It actually showed what I said happened. And so I sued for defamation and wrongful termination in Los Angeles Superior Court in 2016, 4 years ago. The Times filed an anti-SLAPP motion against me, and the civil court judge, Joseph Kalin, ruled in favor of the LA Times and ordered me to pay the LA Times $330,000 in legal fees. We appealed to the Court of Appeal, also in Los Angeles. They also ruled against me. So then we went to the California Supreme Court, Hail Mary pass. They only take fewer than 5% of all petitions for review, but they accepted mine. And they came back and they said, okay, so they were kicking this back to the Court of Appeal. We're remanding it, which is the usual way to do this. We want you to reconsider the case in light of a recent case called Wilson versus CNN, which is another anti-SLAPP case that is very similar to mine. It just went back to them. They were told to reconsider the case completely from scratch. But then on December 20th, the Court of Appeal issued its new opinion, which turned out to be exactly the old opinion. They literally cut and pasted the old opinion, which was 48 pages long, word for word, same formatting, same titles, everything exactly the same, looks exactly the same, is exactly the same. It's almost like the kind of work a lazy college student would do when they're plagiarizing a paper. And then like they inserted a couple hundred words here and there, just changed the dates and stuff like that. Basically, it's the same exact opinion. And so now we're going to petition the Supreme Court again. This is, by the way, something that my lawyers thought would happen. They thought that the justice who wrote the opinion at the Court of Appeal, who was extremely far right, was criticized for her close relationship with the police. She's a former prosecutor, which in my view should be illegal. Judges should not be former prosecutors. Anyway, we thought that she would do the same thing. And so that's exactly what happened. And now we're back where we knew we would be. And we need the Supreme Court to hear the case and to overturn it, because if they don't, there's going to be serious problems for journalists in California, because the Times is not only arguing in my case that they have the right to defame me or any journalist, they're also arguing that they have the right as a media company to racially discriminate or discriminate by gender and other protected classes like age, disability, and so on. So if they win, that would give media companies in the state the right to fire their workers literally for any reason, and they couldn't be held accountable in a court of law.
So how do they justify the latter part of that in terms of race discrimination?
It's unconstitutional, right? Because those protected classes are federal law, and federal law always takes precedence over state law, except in a few things. The argument that they're making, which is pretty ludicrous, is that they have to have the First Amendment right to control the news, not only being able to publish whatever they want, but being able to not publish whatever they want, and not only being able to hire any reporter they want or any cartoonist they want, but to fire any cartoonist that they want. And here's where it gets dicey: for any reason. Because if there are reasons that they can't fire, let's say they don't have a good reason to fire their cartoonist, they have to be able to do it for a bad reason, or they're claiming that they are being forced to continue to publish something or hire someone that they don't want to, which would violate their First Amendment rights. An interesting argument, but it's sophistry.
Well, it's ironically flipped on its head. Last year, you had mentioned 7 First Amendment organizations that filed amicus briefs with the court. Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored is one of those, so full disclosure there. We certainly supported your right not only to be heard in court, but we clearly support the notion that you should never have been fired in the first place. And you have the organization supporting you. But I recall last year, it was a challenge for you to get some First Amendment organizations on board because of the power of just the anti-slap suit as a subject or a topic. And your case particularly points out about how corporations are flipping it on its head and abusing it. Is that accurate?
That's completely accurate. And I think what some of these organizations are failing to see is that there's a cliche in the law that bad cases make bad law. And if I lose, mine would be an example of a strong case for repealing the anti-slap law entirely. One of my attorneys, Jeff Lewis, is a strong proponent of the anti-slap statute. And so is the other one, Roger Lowenstein. One of the reasons that they took my case was that they were worried that a misapplication of the anti-slap law could weaken it politically. And so we're not arguing that the anti-slap law should be repealed, although I personally think it should be. But in court, what we are arguing is that it doesn't apply to me, that basically the law as it stands should not apply to me. For example, there's a test in the anti-slap statute that says that if there's a bare possibility of a case prevailing at trial, then it can go forward. That's one of the 4 prongs of the anti-slap statute. Well, the court ruled that there's no such possibility, because no reasonable person would possibly think I'm right. Now, the thing is, in the world of journalism, everybody thinks I'm right, including right-wing conservatives who hate me. That's just not true that it doesn't have a chance of prevailing at trial, assuming that, you know, a Los Angeles jury is as reasonable as your average journalist. By the way, Buettner has since been fired at the LA Times. He was engaged in an attempted corporate takeover within the boardroom. So they fired him unceremoniously. But the new owner, who is one of these supposedly benevolent newspaper-owning billionaires, is a biotechnology billionaire named Patrick Soon-Shiong, who's kind of a sleazy individual himself. But anyway, he owns the paper and he's kept the case going. I don't know if he's aware of my case or not. I've always wondered if he knew what was going on, whether he would be supportive of this or not, but it's his paper.
But these multi-billion dollar owners of the alleged free press, they're turning the legal system into their plaything for their own agendas and to advance yet more corporate control over information, over the legal system. That seems to be their angle here, which is why they're obviously pursuing it. Let's remind listeners quickly, what's in it in the outcome in terms of Ted Rall? And you've made it very clear that this is not just about you, and there are all kinds of other implications here that are very significant, Ted Rall. But what happens to you if this case doesn't go in your favor?
This is the main event. If the Supreme Court does not hear the case, my case is over. If the Supreme Court does hear it but rules against me, the case is over. And either way, in those two negative scenarios, I'm going to face a judgment of about $1 million in legal fees. Obviously, I would be completely wiped out financially. I mean, the LA Times was paying me $300 a week. I'm not a rich guy. So I think I would have to leave the country and become an exile. I mean, fortunately for me, my mother was French, so I have a French passport. And France is a country that's very friendly to cartooning. They love cartoonists there. But, you know, you have to think about how crazy it is that an American citizen would have to become an anti-SLAPP exile and stop practicing journalism in their home country because of this statute. But that's exactly what would happen.
It's pretty astounding. It's yet another reason why we really wanted to have you back on the program. We're certainly rooting in your favor that this comes down, not just for you, but for all the other implications. Again, I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're talking to journalist and cartoonist Ted Rall. We've been getting an update on his legal case. Ted, could you tell listeners what is the title of your case?
Basically, it's Rall versus Los Angeles Times et al. There's several defendants, Daily Times, the parent company Tribune Publishing, and four individual defendants, Mr. Buettner, an editor, Nicholas Goldberg, a reporter who won the Pulitzer for investigative journalism, Paul Pringle, and my personal favorite, Deirdre Edgar, who was the ethics editor of the LA Times, and she signed the second article that basically itself violates all the ethical guidelines that she herself wrote.
After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Ted Rall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking right now with political cartoonist Ted Rall. You can learn more at rall.com, R-A-L-L. He's cartoonist at anewdomain.net, editor of Skewed News. Ted Rall is a graphic novelist and author of many books of art and prose, including with Harmon Leon, Meet the Deplorables. Also, graphic biographies out on Seven Stories Press, one on Trump, another on Bernie, another on Francis, the People's Pope, also Snowden, one on Snowden. You can learn more at rall.com. Ted Rall, before the break, of course, we were updating people on your anti-SLAPP case and going to the California Supreme Court. However, there are so many other things that you have going on. It's hard to believe that you're juggling as much as you are, given what's on the line for you in the court case. But I'd certainly like to get your input on the fiasco of corporate media coverage of the Democratic primaries. You've written again about this at length. Could you tell our listeners, where are you coming from in terms of media coverage and the framing of Democratic candidates?
It's 2016 all over again. Back in 2016, everybody who was not sleeping under a rock at the time remembers the fix was in both among the Democratic National Committee and the corporate media for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders in the primaries. You're seeing that same thing happen today. I mean, infamously, a memo went out at MSNBC, which is sort of the party organ of the DNC, telling people that Joe Biden is their candidate and everybody needs to get on board with that. And single-handedly, the corporate media has kept Joe Biden's candidacy alive, even though it has, I would say, minimal viability, given the fact that he appears to be suffering from some sort of early onset dementia. He is definitely not as sharp as one would want for a person running for president of the United States. And I don't think that's like a telling secret out of school. Meanwhile, it's very clear that the media is trying to starve the progressive candidates of any kind of attention in the primaries. And only when the so-called progressive candidates tack to the right do they get any kind of approval, as we saw recently with Elizabeth Warren when she reacted to the killing of Qassem Soleimani, the assassination by Trump, where she said, well, he was a terrible guy, he killed hundreds of Americans. This is like the talking point of the militaristic right, that he was responsible for killing hundreds of Americans. And it's like, well, to the extent that what they always leave out is that these hundreds of Americans were U.S. occupation forces in Iraq. And I'm not saying that it's a good thing they're dead or anything, but it certainly is contextually a very important to understand the difference. You know, it's not like they came to Michigan and blew up a mall. These are people who are occupying a foreign country in an illegal war of aggression.
The whole line of propaganda has been challenged on that front, however, going all the way back to Gareth Porter. Recently, Stephen Zunis wrote about this earlier in the program. Kevin Gostola and I discussed this. It's even questionable as to whether or not those claims were true, dating all the way back when Dick Cheney was using them 13 years ago, when Cheney was using it saber rattle against Iran. And so some of these claims have again been recycled. By the way, that gets us into the topic of the Soleimani assassination and the issue of war with Iran. And you just recently wrote about that Iran is not what you think. What are you writing about in that piece?
I felt that reading a lot of the analysis that the one thing that seemed to be missing was the personal touch. It reminded me a lot of back during in 2001 when the Bush administration was preparing to invade Afghanistan, and so few Americans had any sense of what the country was even like or what the people were like, that it seemed like the most journalistically aggressive thing you could do was simply to go to Afghanistan and report back, and that's what I did at the time. And as part of that process, in 2011, I went back to Afghanistan, and just because of the nature of the geography, I was crossing the country through the rural areas, and I didn't want to double back because it's just physically arduous and very dangerous. I wanted to exit via Iran. So I did. You know, I haven't really written much about that because it just hasn't been a topic of great interest until recently, but I decided to just dedicate this week's syndicated column for Creators Syndicate to my brief little oversight of some of my experiences traveling through Iran on the way out of Afghanistan. I wanted people to understand that the big problem here is these people are so much more like Americans than you would possibly think. Temperamentally, there's really no anti-Americanism there, unlike many places like Pakistan, where there's a lot of anti-Americanism on the ground. Iranians are very nice when they learn that you're American. They like us. They don't like our foreign policy. But, right. Hey, I don't like our foreign policy. And it was just interesting as all get up. So I wanted to give people a look in because it's very difficult to get into Iran, even for journalists.
It's actually the case, too, that this piece that you wrote is a great counterbalance. This kind of rogue foreign policy and the way that we get people at home to go on board with it is to dehumanize the other. And your piece is important in counterbalancing that dehumanization effort.
I think that's hugely important, yeah.
You were there, and I think that we don't get enough of that in the corporate media. We get really cartoonish, Hollywood-like villain hero or worldwide wrestling foil and hero kind of narratives. They're very dangerous, and Iran, of course, is not an occupied failed state like we've turned Iraq into. Iran has great military abilities, potential allies, so we could be blundering into a huge disaster, do you think, Ted Rall?
I do. I mean, the thing is, militarily, Iran does not have intercontinental ballistic missiles to strike the United States, and there's no evidence whatsoever that it has nuclear weapons at all. Probably almost certainly does not. They certainly could strike Israel or other American targets throughout the Middle East or American-aligned targets, and not to mention U.S. military bases throughout the region. The country has a real air force, which Afghanistan did not. Iraq was not, under Saddam Hussein, was not able to field an air force against the United States when it invaded in 1991. It's a big change. I mean, the U.S. hasn't had an adversary this formidable, at least since the Vietnam War. And certainly Iran has considerable oil wealth, even though they can't sell it to everybody. They can still sell it to a lot of people. They have a vibrant economy, a very well-educated workforce. It's a modern country. I mean, if you've been to Turkey or Israel, that's pretty much what Iran feels like and looks like in terms of its infrastructure. Not the most modern, you know, it's not Germany, but it's modern. And you wouldn't want to pick a fight with these people.
Well, it's the article is called Iran is Not What You Think. It's available at rall.com. That's RALL.com. And Ted Rall, just as we wrap up the segment here on this Project Censored show, you're working on several other projects, including other books, possibly a movie. Anything you want to share with our listeners to pay attention to rall.com other than the court case we talked about prior?
Well, probably the wackiest, weirdest thing is I have a roman à clé, which is a fancy word for a novel like The Devil Wears Prada, where it's supposedly fiction, but it's based on true characters. And I'm serializing it for free on my website, rall.com. It's called Chain of Command. So just go to rall.com /chain-of-command. And if you hate the Trump administration, you might find it very fun and delicious.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Ted Rall, for all of your really important work, your prolific writing, your graphic biographies, certainly your cartoon strips, as well as animations. Ted Rall, we certainly wish you the best in your legal case against the LA Times, and we will definitely be checking back in with you over the coming months to get some updates. Do you have any kind of time frame on this at this point, your case that we talked about earlier?
You can't tell with the courts, but I'm going to guess it's going to be anywhere from 3 to 6 months from now.
Okay. Well, you can learn more at rall.com, R-A-L-L. Ted Rall, thanks as always for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Thank you.
Land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show, established in 2010 by myself and Dr. Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer and host of the program, Mickey Huff. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations plus around the United States, from Hawaii to New England. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. We can be contacted at projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. Hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip our brothers.